Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You're tuned in to another episode of Real College Podcast, Quarantine Edition, and I'm your host, Casey McCabe. In late March, the Minnesota State Supreme Court overturned the conviction of a Twin Cities man on charges of third-degree criminal sexual conduct on the grounds that the victim had, quote, voluntarily intoxicated herself. The ruling reversed an appellate court decision and ordered a new trial to be set, sparking outrage and protest in the Twin Cities, as well as ongoing activism nationwide. In this extra special episode of Real College Podcast, we will attempt to unpack what happened in March by educating ourselves on the history of sexual assault legislation, speaking with campus experts and discussing what resources students have access to, as well as hearing from gophers about how they keep themselves safe, and an analysis of music therapy and its benefits for victim survivors. You won't want to miss this. Be sure to stick around. Before we can understand what happened in March and what is coming next down the pipe, we need to understand what sexual assault legislation is like in Minnesota and how it got that way. Here to break down the letter of the law is reporter Isaac Maruyama with more.
Sexual violence is a huge problem in colleges across the nation. In 2019, over 1 in 4 undergraduate women at the U of M said that they had experienced sexual assault on campus. But fewer than 6% of these crimes result in an arrest, and fewer than 1% result in a conviction. Why do so many sexual assaults go unpunished? Part of the issue has to deal with the archaic language describing sexual violence in the Minnesota State Constitution. For example, a person who is unwillingly given alcohol or any other substance is considered mentally incapacitated and cannot give consent. But under this language, a person who is assaulted after voluntarily becoming intoxicated may not be able to get justice. That's exactly what happened to Katie Kelly, who was raped in 2019, although her assailant was never charged.
I completed a SANE exam and reported my rape to the Minneapolis Police Department, but the man that raped me was not charged. When I met with the prosecutor on my case to discuss why charges against my rapist were dropped, he informed me that it was a result of how the current rape laws are written. Consequently, I am just one of many victims that are turned away.
The voluntary intoxication loophole isn't the only problem with our existing laws on sexual assault. Another problem is the difficulty of detecting date rape drugs.
Date rape drugs can be eliminated from the body within a couple of hours, making it extremely difficult for blood or urine samples to accurately detect the substances, which means that the state cannot prove the use of force in non-consensual acts.
Even the fact that a victim is unconscious can make pressing charges more difficult.
Because I lost consciousness, they couldn't prove I was non-communicable during the act.
It seems obvious that a person who becomes intoxicated cannot give consent, regardless of whether or not they intended to do so. But until Minnesota's laws are changed, the justice system will continue to interpret them the way they are. That's exactly what the Minnesota Supreme Court decided earlier this year, when it ruled that Francois Mamolu Khalil could not be charged for the rape of a woman who had chosen to drink that night. The case and its controversial ruling sparked a renewed discussion over the issue of sexual assault and the laws surrounding it.
We know changes to our system are necessary. Sexual assault crimes are highly unreported, and when they are reported, there is a very real possibility that they will not be fully investigated or charged or result in conviction.
That's Minnesota State Representative Kylie Mahler, the chief author of a new bill that would update Minnesota's laws on sexual assault and close the voluntary intoxication loophole.
Section 1 adds voluntary intoxication to the current definition of mentally incapacitated. It expands the definition of prohibited occupational relationships to include certain employees in educational settings, as mentioned by Ms. Elwell. Throughout these provisions are changes to the age-related offenses, and as discussed by Ms. Elwell, they include raising the age to protect more minor victims, creating consistent differentials between the age of the actor and complainant, and reducing the age span for the mistake of age defense.
The bill has garnered widespread support from lawmakers and citizens alike. We can all agree that sexual assault is a horrendous crime, and that any victim deserves to have their pain recognized and to get justice. I'll leave you with the words of Killa Marie Granda, the founder and executive director of Unspoken Voices, a nonprofit dedicated to preventing sexual violence and supporting survivors of assault.
7 years ago, I was raped by a man that was in a position of authority, a position of power, a high school principal, who had previously started dating a 16-year-old student who then became his wife. This man brutally raped me over and over again. And I was at the time the Violence Prevention and Response Program Coordinator for the University of Minnesota. That shouldn't have happened to me, right? I shouldn't have let that happen, but it did. It did happen because anyone can be a victim of sexual assault. My rape kit was lost. My urine was lost. My tox results were lost. They were not able to charge. They charged on 2 first degrees and 2 third degrees under mental and physical incapacitation. However, the laws do not allow for that to occur. I have spent 7 years of my life sleepwalking through trying to make change, trying to get someone to listen, to believe the victims and the survivors out there that have not been believed. And it wasn't until serving on these groups or being part of this that I truly began to believe that change can be made. I lost so very, very much because of the assault. I lost my identity. I lost everything about me. I had to rethink who I was. I lived in fear for years. I didn't want to leave my home. It isn't until right now, this year, with this report, with this, what's happening, that I can say I finally got my voice back. And it's not just me, but all of the survivors that I support, all of the survivors I hopefully represent that have asked me to represent them. You are listening to our voices. You are creating systemic change. You are making it so my daughter saw the after effects of my rape, but you're making it so my daughter doesn't have to live in a world of fear and doesn't have to be afraid that what happened to her mom is going to happen to her.
Most of us can't even imagine the pain and suffering that a survivor of sexual assault went through and often continues to go through for years or even decades after. But all of us can support changing our laws to make it easier for survivors to get justice, and hopefully some measure of closure. If you live in Minnesota and would like to support Representative Mahler's bill, House File 707, contact your local representatives and tell them to vote for it. If you or anyone you know has experienced sexual assault, contact the Aurora Center's 24-hour hotline at 612-626-9111. For Real College Podcast on Radio K, this is Isaac Maruyama.
In March, the wave of outcry started by the Minnesota Supreme Court ruling on sexual assault and incapacitation reached us here at the University of Minnesota. Although the decision sparked protests, social media activism, and public discussion surrounding the wider issues of gendered violence, the climate surrounding sexual assault here on campus is undoubtedly much different than the rest of the state. In an effort to understand how sexual violence is handled here on campus and what resources students have access to, Emma and I spoke with Bronte Stewart-New, who is the Legal Advocacy Coordinator at the Aurora Center. Here is what we discussed. Can you tell us about the Aurora Center, Bronte? What do you guys do?
So the Aurora Center has actually been around for quite some time, but we essentially started probably between 30 and 35 years ago. I think we were essentially the rape crisis center on campus. And we are actually one of the first in the country, to my understanding. So the Aurora Center now is a place on campus where students, faculty, and staff can come seek confidential services regarding issues of sexual violence, domestic violence, stalking, and sexual harassment. So confidential meaning that, you know, we aren't required to give information to campus officials. We aren't required to give information to the state. Information that's shared with our office generally is going to stay within our office. So we don't share stuff. And we're also free. So we work with folks who have experienced violence. We work with folks who are concerned about someone who has experienced violence. And we often also make referrals to different campus departments as well, like student counseling services or Boynton Mental Health. And we're also familiar with plenty of the community agencies as well that can assist folks.
You facilitate some support groups. Could you explain what those are and how to get involved with them?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'll really just kind of talk about how people can seek services generally. So right now, you know, kind of almost maybe post-COVID time, people can always email or call our helpline or utilize our text line, which is only during business hours, to request an appointment. And kind of at that first appointment that they would have with an advocate, whether that be me or someone else in our office, we would kind of just go over confidentiality, but also go over any concerns or kind of time sensitive stuff that an individual might have questions about. And we'll also talk about different options that are available to that student or faculty or staff, whether that be support group, which I can talk about in a little bit, or whether that be kind of one of the other things, many other things that we do. And so support group is just kind of one of the things that we do. We currently have 4 support groups that operate during the academic year and also over the summer. So we have 2 survivor support groups, which are for anyone who has experienced sexual violence. We also have a healing after relationship trauma support group, HEART, which is our relationship violence support group. And then we also have a support group for survivors of color. We do want to be mindful that oppression works in a lot of different ways, and it's something that can very much compound upon many identities that someone might hold. So we want to make sure that we have spaces that are inclusive of all different forms of oppression that folks might be experiencing. We do have hopes of expanding our support groups too, once we get more staff in the office, but those are our 4 support groups right now. So typically the support groups require a brief intake with the facilitator. And that's more just to see if the support group is going to meet the needs of what that person wants. And are there other things that that person may want that can be, essentially, that can be filled?
Could you explain some of the educational opportunities provided by the Aurora Center?
We have a really, really awesome prevention curriculum. And I think it takes the lens of like an anti-oppression lens, in that sexual violence is not something that happens in a vacuum. And so it is really important that we talk about kind of the other forms of oppression that exist in our world, and how we talk about like power and control in our society and how that's kind of echoed on, I guess, a bunch of different levels. So if people are interested in having one of our workshops, whether that be for their class, their student group, their department, they can always reach out to Aurora. There's a link on our website that someone can go to fill out, and it would just ask them questions about what they're looking for. So we have our Power of Respect curriculum, which really unpacks culture that we have that really fosters and perpetuates sexual violence on a multitude of different levels. So it's unpacking that. It's also talking about how to respect boundaries, how to intervene in problematic situations. So talking about kind of bystander intervention. But we also offer a variety of customizable workshop. So if there's a specific topic that people would want to discuss in the realm of sexual violence or relationship violence or stalking or harassment, our prevention team can help come up with something that kind of meets the needs of that group.
How can students get involved?
So we have kind of 3 volunteer roles that people can express interest in. So we have our violence prevention educators, and they do the violence prevention education on campus, so facilitating different workshops and trainings. And then we also have our direct service advocates, and those are the individuals who are essentially taking shifts on our helpline after hours when the office is closed and over the weekends. And so we have those 2 main volunteer roles, and both of those roles currently go through a 40-hour training that we put on usually in the month of like late January, early February, which allows them to be confidential in the state of Minnesota. So there's a 40-hour state mandated training for sexual assault crisis counselors. There's also monthly-ish volunteer meetings that we also require our volunteers to attend to go over any ongoing training, any updates in, you know, in different statutes or laws that kind of govern the different ways that essentially the different statutes that we might be interacting with. And then we also have our special projects volunteers, and those are individuals who haven't gone through the 40-hour training, but they might express interest in helping us with like our social media, or they might express interest in tabling on behalf of Aurora, like at orientation or something like that. So there are people who do a significant amount of outreach, whether it be making buttons, because Aurora, I guess, is known for our buttons, or really just meeting with people during tabling and talking about the different things that Aurora does.
Post-COVID, what changes are going to be happening at the Aurora Center? Will there be any new services or changes?
We would hope that we would be able to provide services in person again. And that's, you know, I do want to also like point out that if people need like a confidential space to take an appointment, or if they would prefer to meet in person. You know, those are things that we can definitely do, like masked and safely. But, you know, we hope that we'll get some new staff, and we actually have a new staff member that is going to be starting soon, our legal advocacy diversity coordinator. And that individual's role is going to be really kind of bridging the gap between different student communities and different communities on campus who may not feel like they can come to the Aurora Center for a variety of reasons. So we really want to build good relationships with those communities of people and create services that can really benefit them, which is actually how our Survivors of Color support group started. I'm also hoping that soon we can start a LGBTQIA support group too, again, once we have more people in the office. But I mean, really, I think it's just our hope is that we'll be able to go back in person. I miss having my support group in person. We ate a lot of candy.
Is there anything else that you would like our listeners to understand?
I think a big theme that comes up for a lot of the folks that I work with is that occasionally, I don't even know if it's occasionally, I think it's really just in a lot of circumstances, people really question their own experiences. And oftentimes it's a question of, did this really happen? Or was this bad enough for me to feel this way? Or why am I still feeling this way after all this time when this happened however long ago? And I always want to encourage someone that you have this free and confidential service on campus that is going to provide non-judgmental support to you to talk about whatever it is that you feel like needs to be talked about. And chances are, if someone is questioning why they might still feel a certain way after something happened significantly long ago, chances are there's like a lot of research about how trauma works to validate why they still might be feeling that way. At the end of the day, that's really what we want to do, is educate people on how all of this stuff works. Like, not only kind of the, like, you know, the psychoeducational component of it, but also like how it might impact someone on a day-to-day basis as well. Oftentimes crimes of sexual violence or harassment or stalking or relationship violence are happening in isolation where there aren't really other people around who might not necessarily be witnessing what's going on firsthand. And there can be so much an impacted person is thinking about that really just might prevent them from seeking help. So I always just want people to know that we are always open to kind of talking through specific or hypothetical or whatever, what if situations. And we're going to do that without judgment. We're never going to tell someone that they should report. We're never going to tell someone what they should do. We just want to offer different options and resources so that someone feels more empowered in understanding that their feelings are valid and real, but also that they have options of moving forward that don't involve just, I'm not going to deal with this now. I'm not going to deal with this ever. I'm going to brush it under the rug and hopefully it kind of stays there.
After talking with Bronte, Emma and I still wanted to know more about how students are getting involved in making change here on campus and what students' opinions are about the ruling. Luckily, we were able to speak with Alicia Leisinger, a health promotion specialist at Boynton Health. Here is what we discussed. Can you tell us a bit about yourself and your position?
Yeah, so my name is Alicia Leisinger, and I work as a health promotion specialist at Boynton Health. We have a small health promotion team, and I focus specifically on the issue of sexual violence prevention. As part of my role in that, I also co-chair the Student Education and Engagement Committee of the President's Initiative to Prevent Sexual Misconduct.
What is the President's Initiative? Can you tell us more?
The President's Initiative to Prevent Sexual Misconduct started about 5 years ago and is a campus-wide effort to prevent sexual misconduct. And it brings in a lot of different stakeholders across the university campus. I would say like over 100 people kind of serve in varying roles on the various committees of the President's Initiative, all working towards the goal of prevention. So there have been things like required employee trainings. I think there have been two over the course of the last 3 years or so that I've served in the role, and other things where they're working with academic units to try to improve the climate within academic units. And then my work really focuses on students and engaging students in developing and implementing initiatives and strategies that will meet their prevention needs.
What is SHADE, and what does Boynton have to do with sexual violence and misconduct?
shade has shifted a bit over the last 2 years or so, where at the end of spring semester of 2020, and this was unrelated to COVID, it was sort of a planned change, the student group of shade was sunset. And that was, I think, a decision that was made in collaboration with the shade student employees and shade volunteers, but was really in response to the changing needs of students and just the availability of accessible and engaging sexual health information, resources on campus. So although that student group no longer exists, all of the sexual health promotion programming that Boynton Health offered continues to exist. So Boynton still provides reliable free access to safer sex supplies, to medically accurate information. Basically, the resources are still there, just the student group isn't really functioning as it used to.
What is the University of Minnesota's policy surrounding sexual violence?
We at the university, we have a policy on sexual harassment, sexual assault, stalking, and relationship violence, and we use an affirmative consent standard within our definition of sexual assault for that policy, where consent isn't able to be obtained if someone is incapacitated. And the policy really outlines like what that could look like, indicators of that, like a lack of control over one's movements, an inability to effectively communicate, and a lack of awareness about your own surroundings or circumstances. So there is a limit. I mean, I think like the most important thing for students to know is that there is a point at which if you are too drunk, you're not able to consent.
How can students get involved?
One of the groups that's been really active, I think in particular with undergraduate students, is the MSA's Sexual Assault Task Force. They've done some great work this semester advocating for changes to Minnesota state law related to the Supreme Court case. They've been a really active group, both kind of like, you know, external to like that sort of advocacy work, but also helping kind of keep, as staff, our eye on what issues most matter to students related to this and how to best meet their needs. So MSA Sexual Assault Task Force, I think, is a great place for students to dip their toe in and get involved.
What happened in March? Can you explain this to our listeners?
In March, Minnesota Supreme Court ruled that the current legislative definition of mentally incapacitated, which is part of the state's criminal sexual conduct code, does not include a person who is voluntarily intoxicated by alcohol. The language is actually like administered to the person without the person's agreement within that definition. And it's a huge gap that I think advocates within this area have been aware of and have been advocating for a change for a long time. You know, there should be really no difference in your ability to consent, whether you were drugged by someone or whether you voluntarily drank that much. And that shouldn't impact your ability to, you know, from my perspective, that doesn't impact your ability to give consent. If you're incapacitated, no matter how it happened, you're incapacitated and you aren't able to consent.
What does this ruling mean for us here in Minnesota?
I think that the Supreme Court really, that decision really put a spotlight on Minnesota, like nationally, but also globally, I think, and in a really important way, that there's a huge gap in our state statute and victim survivors are suffering as a result because they don't have the same opportunities to get accountability for what happened to them. So to me, it really allows victims in that situation to seek criminal charges if they choose to, and a change to the state law would really benefit victim survivors in this circumstance.
What was the reaction like on campus? What have students been doing to challenge this?
So MSA has been really active supporting a bill. So there is still, even though legislative session is over, because the budget bills haven't passed yet, there's still a chance that this could occur. So the legislature has, I think, in the public safety omnibus budget bill, there is a change in the way that they would define mentally incapacitated so that this gap no longer exists. And MSA has been really great in advocating for that change. They passed a resolution to support that bill. Within university settings, the Faculty Consultative Committee has taken some action to advocate for passage of this bill. And frankly, like what I hear from students is that the decision and all of the press that came as a result of it really made them question, like, what is university policy related to this? And a change in the state law would, I think, help the state law more closely align with what the university already has on our university policy.
What post-COVID changes will be happening at Boynton with respect to SHADE and sexual assault services? Will there be any new programs or services?
We are working really hard at developing programs within the communities that students interact with on a daily basis. And so we've done, as a committee, a series of assessments. The first was focused on fraternity and sorority students. The second was on LGBTQ undergraduate students. And we basically interviewed between 30 and 40 students for each of those assessments to try to understand what their unique needs were, what are their needs related to sexual violence prevention, but also their experiences with it, and what can we do as a university to help protect them and promote the healthy norms that already exist within those communities and do more to curtail some of those problematic behaviors.
What was the outcome of your assessments? What were your findings?
And so from those two assessments, we this fall are planning to launch a series of programs. One is specific to fraternity and sorority students, and it's called Prevention Advocates. So it's sort of modeled off of a program that students might be familiar with called Health Advocates. But Prevention Advocates is basically 1 to 3 students within each fraternity or sorority chapter who will attend trainings and biweekly meetings and are helping facilitate conversations, trainings, and changes within their own chapter to prevent sexual assault and sexual misconduct. So that program is launching this fall. We have 40 students signed up for it, and I'm pretty excited about the launch of it. So we're going to be focusing on some of those bystander intervention skills, the importance of affirmative consent, decreasing that peer pressure to engage in sex, and also talking a lot about alcohol and sexual consent and helping students, you know, navigate some of those situations where alcohol is involved in sexual interactions. The other assessment that focused on LGBTQ undergraduate students, there's sort of 3 primary strategies coming out of that. One is a LGBTQ sexual health education curriculum that will be offered in partnership with the Gender and Sexuality Center for queer and trans life. And then a second strategy is really about amplifying academic course offerings that look at sexual violence from a power-based lens and really center the experiences of LGBTQ folks within that discussion. And then the third is a grant program for LGBTQ peer-based healthy norms promotion. So there's all sorts of really great things that LGBTQ peers are already doing to practice consent, for instance, outside of sexual interactions. And so the more we can kind of amplify that among peer groups, I think the more effective we'll be in our prevention efforts.
Thank you so much to Alicia and Bronte for the great work that they are doing to help keep our campus a safe and welcoming space for all. If you're interested in getting involved with the Aurora Center, you can visit their website at aurora.umn.edu.
For Real College Podcast, I'm Emma Morris.
And I'm Casey McCabe, signing off. In the next segment of the podcast, we will hear from reporter Max Kelber as he takes to the streets to ask our fellow Gophers how they keep themselves safe. Here's Max with more.
When I transferred to the U of M this past fall semester, I began receiving Safe U texts, causing me to realize how little I do to ensure my own safety. So for this week's episode, I decided to ask my fellow students what safety precautions they take when leaving the house.
I don't go on my phone. I rarely put headphones in or use headphones. I look around me a lot, and that's basically it.
Generally, I still try not to go out very much or not go to very crowded places. I've been fully vaccinated for like a month now, so I definitely feel more comfortable seeing closer groups of friends and groups that I'm more familiar with, and I know they're kind of generally being safe as well. But yeah, since getting vaccinated, I've definitely opened my bubble more.
If I go out at night alone, I usually carry an umbrella because it's supposed to like make people not want to mess with you so much. All right, now I've got to go to work. Sorry. No.
I have pepper spray, and I also have a knife that I sometimes carry, but it kind of freaks me out a little bit.
Yeah, I also carry my pepper spray with me like all the time. It's attached to my keys. Normally have it engaged, but don't really like try not to spray it. But you know, sometimes it's kind of fun to spray it into like the bushes or something. You know, if somebody's following yes. me, I want them to know that I have it. So I'm like, I'm ready to spray it into the bushes. If they can see it behind me, they better get a whiff of it.
Try me. Post up and see what happens.
Sometimes carry pepper spray. That's about it.
I bring pepper spray and try to keep my phone out of sight. Basically just stay alert, yeah.
I absolutely take safety precautions. Anytime I go out, especially at night, I have my pepper spray on me, like almost in my hands, and keys, which kind of sucks. Like I kind of wish I didn't have to do that, but, and just being hypervigilant, especially at night, cause I'll be walking home to my car from like friends' houses and stuff, and I can't relax, which really sucks. But yep, always being precautious.
I mean, I'm a girl and I'm like tiny, so yeah, I take a few precautions trying to be safe and trying to make sure everything's like inside where it needs to be. If I have my phone, I'm holding it. Yeah, that's about it. I feel like depending on where I am, like in downtown Minneapolis, I have like pepper spray and that stuff.
For sure.
Yeah, honestly, I don't. I probably should, but I know they said you shouldn't like walk around with your phone out or just like be attentive of like what's going on, but that's probably it.
That's all for me this week, folks. Special thanks to our subjects for taking time out of their busy days to chat with me. For Radio K's Real College Podcast, this is Max Kelber signing off.
As we work to strengthen legislation surrounding sexual violence and gain justice for victim survivors, we must also attend to their needs after experiencing severe trauma. In the final segment of this episode, we will hear from reporter Ethan Olson as he discusses music and its role in therapeutic practice. Here is Ethan with more.
Music is a love for so many around the world, and people dream of becoming professional musicians or composers. It's a way for some to escape for a while. But with it being such a common interest with so many people, it also has the ability to create communities. A section of the music world combines all of these ideas, called music therapy. It may not be as well known as other forms of therapy, but it has the ability to have a profound effect on people.
I thought I wanted to go into like social work. I knew I wanted to be in kind of a service field, a helping profession. But I knew I didn't want to teach music, and I felt like there weren't really other options for people who loved music but also wanted to do outreach and help people.
Natasha Stark is a student here at the U and also a member of the Music Therapy Student Association, which advocates for music therapy on campus by creating communities for self-care and emotional support.
So music therapy is using music to achieve non-musical goals. And this has to happen within a therapeutic relationship between a board-certified music therapist and a service user or service users. So music therapists are trained in essentially harnessing kind of the natural elements of music that humans are drawn to. So like rhythm, beat, melody, dynamics, etc. And we're trained with how to use those elements and music itself to help people achieve their non-musical goals, whatever those goals may be.
Typically, the group is able to schedule a number of events over the school year, but with restrictions on in-person events during the pandemic, they were restricted to a few virtual events.
So in a normal year, we do a lot of social events for members, as well as music, performance type events, and kind of community service type events. This past year was obviously different. Everything was virtual. We couldn't do as much kind of community events as we'd like to, but we're hopeful for this next year that some of our favorite community type events will be back on.
The idea for these events is to create a community for those who are interested in playing music as well as just listening. They're open to all students, so anyone can go to these various ones that will be put on this upcoming year.
So some of our favorites that we've done in the past, we've done jam sessions at the Arts Quarter Festival, which happens usually in October. We participate in Relay for Life, which is a cancer fundraiser. So we usually bring all of our instruments to the relay and set up like a little jam session kind of area, play some music. We've been able to actually perform on the stage before, which is really cool. We do community service. So like around the holidays, we've done caroling at care facilities in the community, hospital waiting rooms. And then we do fundraisers like bake sales. We've done a Chipotle fundraiser in the past. So that's a really easy way for students to get involved, you know, eat at Chipotle, and it helps benefit our organization so we can continue to advocate for music therapy. And one of our favorite events is every Valentine's Day, we do a fundraiser called Valentunes, where people can donate to us and we deliver like singing Valentines. So we will sing like love songs or friendship songs or whatever they want. So that's one of our favorite events and a great way for students to participate in our organization.
MTSA often partners with local music therapists for both events and to expand the education of its members, in which they learn which techniques are most effective.
Usually we're able to connect with some music therapists in the community, and that's how we have those opportunities to do caroling at care facilities, you know.
One of MTSA's main resources for therapy techniques is the Angel Band Project, a network of music therapists and musicians to help others heal after experiencing sexual violence. They describe music therapy as the specialized use of music by a credentialed professional with therapeutic goal in mind. To be credentialed would mean to be certified by the Certification Board of Music Therapy.
Like they say on the website, they use these certain techniques and they do drumming workshops, lyric analysis, all this stuff on here.
The Angel Band Project also uses similar community-centric approaches to MTSA, including dozens of artists in their band so far. But what this project is doing best is setting an example with their techniques for student groups like MTSA. They often hold benefit concerts that can attract a great deal of people, both in person and online with their videos. And MTSA does similar events, so if you want to get involved, go to the Music Therapy Student Association site on GopherLink. I'd like to thank Natasha and MTSA for their help. And this is Ethan Wilson reporting for the Real College Podcast.
That's all for this episode of Real College Podcast. Stay safe, Minnesota. We hope you stay happy, healthy, and connected. Until next time, signing off for Radio K's Real College Podcast, I'm Casey McCabe.